Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 21st, Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19, Cases Falling, Worries Rising, by Meg Wingerter and Joe Rubino. Virus Fears Widen as Omicron Surges Across the Country, by Philip Marcello and Jill Lawless. U.S. Military, Pentagon Rules Look to Stop Rise of Extremism, by Lolita C. Baldor. Voting Rights Bill, Schumer May Target Senate Rules, by Carl Hulse. And following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19, Cases Falling, Worries Rising, as Colorado Stats Improve, Omicron Causing Concern, by Meg Wingerter and Joe Rubino, The Denver Post. New COVID-19 infections and hospitalizations continued to drop in Colorado over the last week, a potential silver lining as the virus's fast-spreading Omicron variant marches across the country. The new variant of the coronavirus so far has been confirmed in only a small number of cases in Colorado, including two announced in Denver on Monday. But Omicron has caused a jump in infections everywhere it has landed, experiencing a six-fold increase nationally over the last week to become the dominant variant in the country. While there's some evidence that Omicron may be less deadly than the Delta variant, which currently is responsible for most cases in Colorado, hospitalizations have increased in countries where Omicron triggered a new case wave. Colorado is in a better position than some places because COVID-19 hospitalizations were falling as Omicron arrived, said Beth Carlton, Associate Professor of Environmental and Occupational Health at the Colorado School of Public Health. If the Delta wave was still increasing demand for hospital beds when Omicron arrived and caused its own wave, it would have put that much more strain on already strapped hospitals, she said. As of Monday afternoon, 1,086 people were hospitalized statewide with confirmed COVID-19. According to data from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, that's the lowest number of patients since October 19th, though it's still a highly elevated level. Capacity remained tight, though, at about 94% of both general and intensive care beds occupied. Hospitals are dealing with more non-COVID patients than they had during the last year's surge, and have had to take beds offline because of a lack of nurses and others to staff them. New cases also were down for the last week, with 10,268 recorded. In one potentially worrisome sign, the 7-day average of new cases rose slightly on Sunday, though. The percentage of tests coming back positive had started to tick up a few days earlier. Some fluctuations end up being insignificant, of course, but an increase in the positivity rate in cases is often followed by an increase in hospitalizations. In the absence of Omicron, things should continue to decline, Carlton said. I think all signs point to that Omicron is in Colorado and starting to proliferate. Omicron has proven adept at outcompeting Delta by spreading more easily and infecting people with some existing immunity, either through vaccination or previous infection. What remains unknown is how severe it may be. hospitalizations rose in South Africa and Denmark after Omicron hit. But the question researchers are still trying to answer is whether that increase is lower than would have been expected, given the number of cases, Carlton said. I think the big question is how much hospital demand Omicron will drive, she said. Denver reported its first two confirmed cases of Omicron on Monday. Neither person had recently traveled, suggesting the variant is spreading at low levels in the city. Both people were fully vaccinated, and one had received a booster. Neither is seriously ill. The Denver Department of Public Health and Environment urged everyone to get vaccinated or get their booster shot. While vaccination seems to offer considerably less protection against Omicron than the Delta variant, it still significantly reduces the odds of hospitalization or death. Denver's mask or vax indoor mask mandate expires on January 3rd, but officials are monitoring case counts and hospitalization rates, and that order could be extended, Bob McDonald, executive director of the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment, said Monday. Right now, the data does not suggest the need for any further restrictions beyond that mandate. We're going to be data-driven, and right now, case rates are dropping, he said. At this point, the vast majority of cases in Denver are caused by Delta, though the experience of other highly vaccinated cities shows Omicron can take over quickly, McDonald said. As of Friday, the state health department had identified 5 Omicron cases, 2 in Arapahoe County, and 1 each in Boulder, Garfield, and Jefferson counties. The last information about the prevalence of different variants came from the week of December 5th and still shows Delta accounting for essentially all new cases in Colorado. But Omicron is quickly spreading across the U.S., jumping from about 13% of new cases last week to 73% this week, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's variants model. Because of delays in reporting, the CDC has to extrapolate based on incomplete data, so the prevalence could be adjusted as more information comes in. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's top infectious diseases expert, warned Sunday that Omicron could cause record numbers of cases and hospitalizations in the coming weeks. In scenes reminiscent of March 2020, professional sports leagues canceled games and New Yorkers stood in long lines to get tested this weekend. It's not the same situation, however, because more than half of Americans have been vaccinated, giving them at least some protection from severe illness. People at high risk of hospitalization also may be able to get treatment with monoclonal antibodies, though 2 of the 3 main options appear to be largely ineffective against Omicron. The Denver Health Department has urged people gathering for the holidays to consider hosting events where everyone over 5 must be vaccinated, getting tested and isolating if the result is positive, wearing a mask in crowds or around unvaccinated people, holding events outdoors or making them shorter, and inviting fewer people. Anyone who's feeling sick should stay home. The safest settings are those where everyone is fully vaccinated. And when I say fully vaccinated, I mean boosted as well, McDonald said. Virus fears widen as Omicron surges across the country, by Philip Marcello and Jill Lawless, The Associated Press, Byline, Boston. The nation's second largest city called off its New Year's Eve celebration Monday, and its smallest state reimposed an indoor mask mandate as the Omicron variant leaped ahead of other variants to become the dominant version of the coronavirus in the U.S. The moves in Los Angeles and Rhode Island reflected widening fears of a potentially devastating winter COVID-19 surge. Much of the concern is being driven by Omicron, which federal health officials announced accounted for 73% of new infections last week, a nearly 6-fold increase in only 7 days. Omicron's prevalence is even higher in some parts of the U.S., It's responsible for an estimated 90% of new infections in the New York area, the Southeast, the industrial Midwest, and the Pacific Northwest, federal officials said. The announcement underscored the variant's remarkable ability to race across oceans and continents. It was first reported in southern Africa less than a month ago. Scientists say Omicron spreads more easily than other coronavirus strains, including Delta, though many details about it remain unknown, including whether it causes more or less severe illness. But even if it is milder, the new variant could still overwhelm health systems because of the sheer number of infections. Organizers of the New Year's Eve party planned for Grand Park in downtown LA nixed plans for an in-person audience, saying the event will be live streamed instead, as it was last year. In Rhode Island, which has the most new cases per capita over the last 2 weeks, mass or proof of vaccination will be required in most indoor establishments for at least the next 30 days. And in Boston, the city's new Democratic mayor announced to howls of protest that anyone entering a restaurant, bar, or other indoor business will need to show proof of vaccination starting next month. There is nothing more American than coming together to ensure that we're taking care of each other, Mayor Michelle Wu said at City Hall as protesters blew whistles and shouted, "Shame on Wu." President Joe Biden planned to address the nation on the latest variant on Tuesday, less than a year after he suggested that the country would essentially be back to normal by Christmas. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the president would issue a stark warning and make clear that unvaccinated individuals will continue to drive hospitalizations and deaths, she said. U.S. vaccine maker Moderna announced Monday that lab tests suggested that a booster dose of its vaccine should offer protection against Omicron. Similar testing by Pfizer on its vaccine also found that a booster triggered a big jump in Omicron-fighting antibodies. The country is averaging nearly 130,500 new COVID-19 cases a day, up from about 122,000 a day 2 weeks ago, according to Johns Hopkins University data. In Texas, a hospital system in Houston reports that Omicron already accounts for 82% of new symptomatic COVID-19 cases it is treating, a dramatic increase from Friday, when testing showed it was responsible for just 45% of the system's cases. But in Missouri, an early epicenter of the Delta surge, the variant still accounts for 98 to 99% of COVID-19 samples, according to the state's Department of Health and Senior Services. In Kansas, rural hospitals are struggling to transfer patients, with some left stranded in emergency rooms for a week while they wait for a bed. U.S. military, Pentagon rules look to stop rise of extremism by Lolita C. Baldor, the Associated Press, byline, Washington. Warning that extremism in the ranks is increasing, Pentagon officials issued new rules Monday prohibiting service members from actively engaging in extremist activities. The new guidelines come nearly a year after some current and former service members participated in the riot at the U.S. Capitol, triggering a broad department review. According to the Pentagon, fewer than 100 military members are known to have been involved in substantiated cases of extremist activity in the past year. However, they warn that the number may grow given recent spikes in domestic violent extremism, particularly among veterans. Officials said the new policy doesn't largely change what is prohibited, but is more of an effort to make sure troops are clear on what they can and can't do while still protecting the First Amendment right to free speech. And for the first time, it is far more specific about social media. The new policy lays out in detail the banned activities, which range from advocating terrorism or supporting the overthrow of the government to fundraising or rallying on behalf of an extremist group or liking or reposting extremist views on social media. The rules also specify that commanders must determine two things in order for someone to be held accountable: that the action was an extremist activity, as defined in the rules, and that the service member actively participated in that prohibited activity. Previous policies banned extremist activities, but didn't go into such great detail, and also did not specify the two-step process to determine if someone is accountable. "What was wrong yesterday is still wrong today," said one senior defense official. But several officials said that as a study group spoke with service members this year, they found that many wanted clearer definitions of what was not allowed. The officials provided additional details about the rules on condition of anonymity because they were not made public. The military has long been aware of small numbers of white supremacists and other extremists among the troops. But Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and other leaders launched a broader campaign to root out extremism in the force after it became clear that military veterans and some current service members were present at the January 6th insurrection. In a message to the force on Monday, Austin said the department believes that only a few service members violate their oath and participate in extremist activities. But, he added, even the actions of a few can have an outsized impact on unit cohesion, morale, and readiness, and the physical harm some of these activities can engender can undermine the safety of our people. The risk of extremism in the military can be more dangerous because many service members have access to classified information about sensitive military operations or other national security information that could help adversaries. And extremist groups routinely recruit former and current service members because of their familiarity with weapons and combat tactics. The number of substantiated cases may be small compared to the size of the military, which includes more than 2 million active duty and reserve troops. But the number appears to be an increase over previous years. Officials also noted that data has not been consistent, so it is difficult to identify trends. The new rules do not provide a list of extremist organizations. Instead, it is up to commanders to determine if a service member is actively conducting extremist activities based on the definitions, rather than on a list of groups that may be constantly changing, officials said. Asked whether troops can simply be members of an extremist organization, officials said the rules effectively prohibit membership in any meaningful way, such as the payment of dues or other actions that could be considered active participation. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby told reporters that there's not a whole lot about membership in a group that you're going to be able to get away with. He added, in order to prove your membership, you're probably going to run afoul of one of these criteria. Kirby also said that commanders will evaluate each case individually. So simply clicking like on one social media post, for example, might not merit punishment, depending on all the circumstances involved. Voting Rights Bill. Schumer may target Senate rules. By Carl Hulse, The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. Stymied by Republicans on voting rights legislation, Senator Chuck Schumer on Monday gave the clearest sign yet that he would try to force a fundamental change in Senate rules, if needed, to enact federal laws to offset voting restrictions being imposed by Republican-led legislatures around the country. In a letter to colleagues, Schumer, a Democrat of New York, the majority leader, said that the Senate would take up stalled voting rights legislation as early as the first week of January, and that if Republicans continued to filibuster, the Senate would consider changes to any rules which prevent us from debating and reaching final conclusion on important legislation. But it's not clear how far Democrats will be willing or able to go in working around the 60-vote requirement for most legislation and finding a way to pass voting rights legislation with a simple majority. While several formerly reluctant senators have in recent weeks endorsed rules change for voting issues, at least two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kirsten Sinema of Arizona have resisted. Alarmed by state laws being enacted in the aftermath of the 2020 election that seem aimed at making it more difficult for people, particularly minorities, to vote, Democrats have tried repeatedly this year to set federal standards for early and mail-in voting and curb partisan gerrymandering, among other provisions. But they have been consistently thwarted by a Republican blockade. To this point, Democrats have not pressed the issue. But Schumer's new stance shows that he is ready to take the next step and start a rules fight on the Senate floor, though he has so far lacked the 50 Democratic votes needed to force through a change over Republican opposition. Schumer's move seems intended to change the dynamic of the debate and put new pressure on his colleagues to back a change. Schumer's frustration boiled over in his letter, saying it was unfair to let states set new rules through partisan majority votes while Republicans were preventing the Senate from doing the same. "I would ask you to consider this question," he wrote. "If the right to vote is the cornerstone of our democracy, then how can we in good conscience allow for a situation in which the Republican Party can debate and pass voter suppression laws at the state level with only a simple majority vote, but not allow the United States Senate to do the same?" Schumer has in the past said mainly that all options are on the table when it comes to pressing voting rights legislation, refraining from a direct threat on Senate rules. A group of more moderate Senate Democrats have been engaged in negotiations on rules changes with Manchin and Sinema and have reported some progress, but no breakthrough. While Manchin on Sunday shattered Democratic plans to push forward on a sweeping social policy and climate change bill, he opened the door a crack to potential changes in Senate rules. "If you can make the Senate work better, the rules are something we've changed over the years. 232 years, there's been rule changes," Manchin said Sunday on Fox News. However, he also suggested that he might be interested in more modest changes than Schumer and others are contemplating, saying he would continue to support the 60-vote supermajority threshold to overcome a filibuster. Sinema has also drawn a line against partisan changes in the rules, but Democrats say they believe she would not want to be the lone holdout if Manchin were persuaded to relent on the legislative filibuster. Democrats, knowledgeable about the internal deliberations, say that many possible changes are under consideration, including weakening the filibuster against the preliminary motion to proceed to bring legislation to the floor for consideration. However, in a more significant move, Democrats say they are also discussing a change that would clear the way for final action on a bill through a simple majority vote after guaranteeing opponents the opportunity to alter the legislation through a significant number of amendments. Instituting such a change would require the support of all 50 Democrats and the vote of Vice President Kamala Harris, presiding to break a tie in the 50-50 Senate. The Democratic voting rights and rules change push would likely meet universal resistance from Republicans. Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, the minority leader, last week accused Democrats of rattling swords about changing the structure of the Senate and commended Manchin for opposing it. Dems trying to build back after Manchin tanks $2 trillion bill. By Lisa Mascaro and Farnoosh Amiri, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Democrats are struggling to pick up the pieces after Senator Joe Manchin effectively crushed President Joe Biden's big domestic policy bill. But they face serious questions whether the $2 trillion initiative can be refashioned to win his crucial vote or the party will be saddled with a devastating defeat. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed on Monday that the chamber would vote early in the new year on Biden's Build Back Better Act as it now stands, so every senator has the opportunity to make their position known on the Senate floor, not just on television. That was a biting reference to Manchin's sudden TV announcement against the bill on Sunday. Biden and Manchin spoke later Sunday, according to a person familiar with the call, first reported by Politico. It was cordial and respectful, said the person, who spoke only on condition of anonymity. However, the conservative West Virginia Democrat and his party are so far apart, his relationship so bruised after months of failed talks, it's unclear how they even get back to the negotiating table, let alone revive the sprawling more than 2,100-page social services and climate change bill. We're going to work like hell to get it done, said White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, repeating the phrase several times at a briefing, but never saying how. The setback throws Biden's signature legislative effort into deep doubt at a critical time, closing out the end of the president's first year and ahead of congressional midterm elections when the Democrats' slim hold on Congress is at risk. Coupled with solid Republican opposition, Manchin's vote is vital in the 50-50 split Senate on this and other initiatives, including the Democrats' priority voting rights legislation that Schumer also promised would come to an early vote. From the White House, Psaki struck a more conciliatory tone than her weekend hardball reaction to Manchin, saying Biden is a longtime friend of the senator, and the president is focused on moving forward. Vice President Kamala Harris told CBS News, "The stakes are too high for this to be about any specific individual." She said, "This is about let's get the job done." Steeped in the politics of a state that Biden lost decisively to Donald Trump, Manchin has little to gain from aligning too closely with fellow Democrats, raising fresh questions over whether he still has a place in the party. In a radio interview Monday, he reiterated his position that the social and environment bill has far too much government spending on child care, health care, and other programs without enough restrictions on income or work requirements. In news briefs, Trump sues New York Attorney General, seeks halt to probe, Byline, New York. Former President Donald Trump sued New York Attorney General Letitia James on Monday, resorting to a familiar strategy as he seeks to end a years-long civil investigation into his business practices that he alleges is purely political. In the lawsuit filed in federal court 2 weeks after James requested that Trump sit for a January 7th deposition, Trump contends the probe into matters including his company's valuation of assets has violated his constitutional rights in a thinly veiled effort to publicly malign Trump and his associates. The lawsuit describes James, a Democrat, as having personal disdain for the Republican ex-president and points to numerous statements she's made about him, including her boast that her office sued his administration 76 times and tweets during her 2018 campaign that she had her eyes on Trump Tower and that Trump was running out of time. January 6th committee seeks interview with GOP Representative Scott Perry, Byline, Washington. The House panel investigating the January 6th U.S. Capitol insurrection requested an interview and documents from Republican Representative Scott Perry of Pennsylvania on Monday, marking the first time the committee publicly sought to sit down with a sitting member of Congress. The latest request launches a new phase for the lawmakers on the committee, who have so far resisted reaching out to one of their own as they investigate the insurrection by President Donald Trump's supporters and his efforts to overturn the election. Perry and other congressional Republicans met with Trump ahead of the attack and strategized about how they could block the results at the January 6th electoral count. Perry, representing Pennsylvania's 10th district, was cited more than 50 times in a Senate Judiciary report released in October. EU approves fifth COVID-19 vaccine for Bloc, Byline, The Hague, Netherlands. The European Union's executive branch on Monday authorized a fifth COVID-19 vaccine for use in the 27-nation Bloc, giving the green light to the two-dose vaccine made by U.S. biotech company Novavax. the European Commission confirmed a recommendation from the bloc's drug regulator to grant conditional marketing authorization for the vaccine for people ages 18 and over. The decision comes as many European nations are battling surges in infections and amid concerns about the spread of the new Omicron variant. Novavax said it's testing how its shots will hold up against Omicron, and like other manufacturers, has begun formulating an updated version to better match that variant in case it's eventually needed. December 15th, storms across north central U.S. classified as derecho, byline O'Fallon, Missouri. A line of severe thunderstorms and tornadoes that swept across the north central U.S. last week was the result of a serial derecho, the first on record in December, officials with the National Weather Service said Monday. At least 45 tornadoes have been preliminarily confirmed in the December 15th storms that crossed the Great Plains and Midwest amid unseasonably warm temperatures, said Bill Bunting, chief of forecast operations at the Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center. Nebraska, Iowa, and Minnesota took the brunt of the damage. Bunting said at least 12 of the tornadoes were rated EF2. Many of the thunderstorms also carried winds of up to 80 miles per hour. Five deaths were blamed on the weather. A derecho is often described as an inland hurricane, but it has no eye and its winds come across in a line. The similarity is in the damage, which is likely to spread over a wide area, unlike a tornado where the damage is more spotty. These were from Denver Post wire reports. Killing of Dante Wright. No verdict yet in trial of Minneapolis police officer by Amy Ferlitti and Scott Bauer, the Associated Press, byline Minneapolis. The suburban Minneapolis police officer who says she meant to use her taser instead of her gun when she shot and killed black motorist Dante Wright made a blunder of epic proportions and did not have a license to kill, a prosecutor told jurors on Monday, shortly before they began deliberating on her manslaughter trial. Kim Potter's attorney, Earl Gray, countered during closing arguments that the former Brooklyn Center officer made an honest mistake by pulling her handgun instead of her taser, and that shooting Wright wasn't a crime. In the walk of life, nobody's perfect. Everybody makes mistakes, Gray said. My gosh, a mistake is not a crime. It just isn't in our freedom-loving country. The mostly white jury began deliberating shortly before 1 p.m. and quit for the day around 6 p.m. without reaching a verdict. They will be sequestered until they finish. Potter, who is white, is charged with first and second degree manslaughter in the April 11th shooting, which came after Wright was pulled over for having expired license plate tags and an air freshener hanging from his rearview mirror. Prosecutor Aaron Eldridge said during her summation that Wright's death was entirely preventable, totally avoidable. Claiming it was a mistake is not a defense, she said, pointing out that the words accident and mistake don't appear in jury instructions. Accidents can still be crimes if they occur as a result of reckless or culpable negligence, Eldridge said. She drew a deadly weapon, Eldridge said. She aimed it. She pointed it at Dante Wright's chest, and she fired. Gray argued that Wright caused the whole incident because he tried to flee from police during a traffic stop. Potter mistakenly grabbed her gun instead of her taser because the traffic stop was chaos, he said. Dante Wright caused his own death, unfortunately, he asserted. Potter, 49, testified Friday that she didn't want to hurt anybody, that she was sorry it happened, and that she doesn't remember what she said or everything that happened after the shooting, as much as her memory of those moments is missing. City Council. Denver sets 20-mile-per-hour default speed limit by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. The speed limit on most of Denver's neighborhood streets will be reset at 20 miles per hour after the City Council voted Monday to reduce the city's default limit from 25 miles per hour. The change, which will go into effect as soon as Mayor Michael Hancock signs the ordinance, is aimed not just at dampening danger and increasing pedestrian and cyclist control in residential parts of the city, but also helping spur a culture change amid an increase in the number of traffic deaths in Denver this year. There's no illusions that dropping neighborhood speeds from 25 to 20 is the single silver bullet needed to reduce the chaos on Denver streets. City Councilman Paul Cashman, the ordinance's sponsor, said at a council safety committee hearing earlier this month. It's the beginning of a change of culture and a way of thinking that we just need to slow down. As outlined in Cashman's research, a AAA study found that the risk of death for a pedestrian hit by a car going 32 miles per hour is 150% higher than if the car were going 23 miles per hour. Cashman said the change is not intended to give Denver police a gotcha enforcement policy. Ron Thomas, the Denver Police Department's division chief for parole, told the safety committee the department plans to focus on educating drivers. The 20 is Plenty campaign that resulted in Monday's law change has been more than a year in the making. The council voted to amend the city's 2021 budget to include $350,000 for a feasibility study to look at lowering speed limits on all types of city streets. But Monday's ordinance comes with an uncertain price tag that could take years to be put into effect uniformly across the city. While the default speed limit on streets with no speed limit signs will immediately change with the mayor's signature, there are between 2,700 and 3,500 signs reading 25 miles per hour that the city's Department of Transportation and Infrastructure will have to get rid of and, in some cases, replace, officials say. That work, contingent on finding available contractors to make and install new signs and dispose of old ones, could cost between $1.2 million and $1.5 million, according to senior city planner Mike King. It could take between 3 and 5 years to complete. Overall, the total number of signs posted on neighborhood streets will be reduced to around 1,000, with a focus on putting signs in places where people get off arterial streets and enter neighborhoods. The possible $1.5 million tab troubled Councilwoman Kendra Black, who said she routinely hears from residents that want to see safety improvement on thoroughfares like Colorado Boulevard and Quincy Avenue in her southeast Denver district. Those streets would not be impacted by the speed limit change. Pointing to the limited funding available for city transportation projects, Black cast the lone no vote Monday. The ordinance passed 11-1. At the safety committee hearing earlier this month, King said that the city's traffic engineer is typically in charge of setting speed limits on streets, but passing an ordinance to lower the city's default speed limit and also formally reduce the speed limit in city parks to 15 miles per hour is an important step in a broader plan to improve roadway safety. The next step following this is looking at collectors and arterials, King told the safety committee. Those are the streets like the Hampton Avenues and the areas where we do see those higher fatal crash rates. Denver Mayor Michael Hancock announced his Vision Zero Roadway Safety Initiative in 2017. The goal is to eliminate traffic-related deaths on city streets by 2030. But after seeing a decrease in traffic-related fatalities among COVID-19 lockdowns last year, there have been 80 such deaths in Denver so far this year, city data shows, by far the highest total since Vision Zero was launched. While other council members voice skepticism that lowering speeds on typically quiet neighborhood streets will make a dent in the city's troubling traffic death trend, they agreed it is a step in the right direction. But it can't be the last step. Street design in particular is worrisome, Councilman Kevin Flynn said. In his Southwest Denver district, wide streets invite drivers to go faster than 20 miles per hour. Jill Locantore, executive director of advocacy group, the Denver Streets Partnership, urged the council to pass the speed limit reduction Monday, but also spoke to the need for better infrastructure and street layouts to slow drivers. "We know that street design is ultimately the best way to reinforce safety," she said. Board reverses label change. Panel tables moved to remove the term sex offenders at urging a POLIS appointee by Alex Burness, the Denver Post. Under pressure from the governor and the state's public safety director, Colorado's Sex Offender Management Board has reversed its controversial November decision to scrap the term sex offenders in its own guiding principles in favor of adults who commit sexual offenses. The board, commonly referred to as the SOMB, voted 16-2 on Friday to table the language change matter and refer it back to a subcommittee. It's possible the board votes again to change terminology in the future, but the tabling means it's not likely to happen anytime soon. The decision followed a 10-6 vote by the board in November to stop using sex offenders in its own principles and policies. The board controls treatment standards for people convicted of sex offenses, and changing the language in this way would not have affected treatment or management policies. However, it was hailed by supporters as an important step away from labels and toward person-first language that research shows can improve rehabilitation prospects. After the November vote, however, the board opened a public comment period. That's where things went off track. The language change had gotten coverage on talk radio, on Fox News, and in the Daily Caller, in addition to various Colorado outlets. More than 400 people submitted comment on the matter, an overwhelming number for a state board that tends to generate little public attention. Public defenders and people who've committed sexual offenses, plus their family members and advocates, were supportive of the change. But comments from victim advocates and members of the general public were by far in favor of no language change. Law enforcement leaders also have opposed the change from the start. The coddling from some of the offender-affiliated representatives was repugnant, tweeted Colorado sex assault survivor and motivational speaker Kimberly Corbin 2 days after the vote on the language change. "This shift is offensive to those of us who have experienced victimization at the hands of sex offenders who don't like their label." On Thursday, the day before the board's reversal vote, Democratic Governor Jared Polis sent a letter to Kimberly Klein, the chair of the SOMB. "We must be wary not to normalize violent acts of sexual aggression or even give the appearance of normalizing such unacceptable behavior," he wrote. "I hope that the board will reevaluate its previous decision to allow for additional discussions with the wider community, including carefully examining potential trauma to victims and ensuring that a clear message continues to be sent to the general public that non-consensual sexual aggression is not acceptable or tolerated in Colorado." Polis also expressed concern that the SOMB, a 25-member board, when fully seated, had only 16 of its members present for the November vote. Polis appointee Stan Hilke, director of the Colorado Department of Public Safety, said the same in his own letter to Klein. "The oddity of this policy change occurring without the true board majority subjects the SOMB and CDPS to public scrutiny," Hilke wrote. Hilke suggested that, as director of the department that oversees the SOMB, he would likely reject the new language as a policy change. "I wish to avoid a scenario where the board and the department are not in alignment on the issue, which would place community trust, credibility, and relevance of both entities at peril of reputational harm that could jeopardize our collective success," he wrote. "While unintended, I am concerned that this is on a path to cause more harm than was trying to be fixed within the narrow intent of the trauma-informed language in the first place." Polis and Hilke got their way, to the frustration of reform-minded advocates. "The research is overwhelming that how we label people impacts their ability to build healthy, pro-social identities and lifestyles that are incompatible with sexual offending. Lori Rose Kipros, Director of Sexual Litigation for the Office of the State Public Defender, told the Denver Post. The SOMB standards provide the regulations that govern the professionals charged with supporting these positive changes. So the language should support that mission. Do we want these clients to reoffend or not? This was clients' argument all along, that the language change was not, in fact, anti-victim, but rather pro-rehabilitation and public safety. We're talking about how someone speaks about themselves. That can increase risk. Klein, arguing against labeling people, said ahead of the November vote. Ultimately, it is victim-centered if we're reducing risk. Prosecutors in I-70 trucker trial exchange brake shoe as memento, by Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. The two deputy district attorneys who prosecuted the trucker sentenced last week to 110 years in prison for causing a fatal pileup on Interstate 70 exchanged a trophy-like gift featuring a truck's brake shoe after the guilty verdict, according to a screenshot of a Facebook post by Deputy District Attorney Kayla Wildeman. In the undated post, which appears to have since been deleted or made private, Wildeman wrote that Senior Deputy District Attorney Trevor Moritzky, who worked the trial with her, turned a brake shoe from a semi-truck into a memento. An image attached to the post shows a gold plaque with an apparent brake part. The plaque includes Wildeman's name, the case number for the trucker's case, and the phrase I-70 case. The truck driver, Rogel Aguilera Medeiros, 26, said during the trial that he lost his brakes in Colorado's high country on April 25, 2019, and could not control the semi-trailer he was driving. He ultimately crashed into stopped traffic under an overpass in Lakewood that killed four people in a fiery 28-car pileup. First Judicial District Attorney Alexis King said in a statement Monday that the brake shoe in question was not a piece of evidence from the case. She said it is not normal for prosecutors to exchange gifts to commemorate trial victories. The post was in very poor taste and does not reflect the values of my administration, the statement said. We have addressed it internally. King said through a spokesman that she became aware of the memento and the Facebook post on Monday morning and took immediate action. She did not say what that action was. Wildeman and Moritzky could not be reached for comment Monday. Moritzky was, in June, named one of three finalists to become an Adams County Court judge, but was ultimately not selected to fill the post. Aguilera Medeiros' defense attorney, James Colgan, on Monday said the gift was unprofessional. Lives are ruined all around, and they celebrate, he said. This is very disturbing. Tristan Gorman, legislative policy coordinator for the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar, said about the post. It obviously flies in the face of the prosecution's ethical obligation to seek justice rather than a conviction. It's just bragging rights about a trial win where people on both sides, their lives were either ended or forever changed. The tone of it seems almost like the prosecutor is treating it like a game she won. Douglas Cohen, a defense attorney and former prosecutor in the First Judicial District Attorney's Office, said Monday that high-fiving colleagues is common for trial lawyers on both sides of the aisle. Anyone who tells you otherwise is holier than thou, he said. That said, the brake shoe memento shows a total lack of empathy and dishonors the role of prosecutors. Aguilera Medeiros' 110-year mandatory minimum sentence has been widely criticized since he was sentenced last week, with more than 4.5 million people signing an online petition asking that Governor Jared Polis commute the sentence. Connor Cahill, a spokesman for Polis, said in a statement Monday that the office would expedite consideration of a clemency application from Aguilera Medeiros, but that the truck driver has not yet submitted a request. King said last week that she would welcome a reconsideration of Aguilera Medeiros' sentence, despite her office prosecuting the charges that ensured that 110-year sentence. Aguilera Medeiros' sentence stretched to more than a century because, under Colorado law, first-degree assault and attempted first-degree assault are so-called crimes of violence in which prison sentences must run consecutively and not concurrently when they spring from the same incident. Cohen said the memento should not distract from the larger issues in Aguilera Medeiros' case. Why did the district attorney, who has unfettered discretion in the filing of charges, seek a century-long sentence for a tragic accident, he said. It's a fair question that the legal community and community at large is asking. Arrest made in Colorado in 1978 cold case. Byline, San Francisco. A man was arrested in Colorado on suspicion of killing a teenage girl in San Francisco more than four decades ago, and detectives say he may be a suspect in other unsolved homicides. Mark Stanley Personet, 76, was arrested in suburban Denver on Thursday following a joint operation by San Francisco Police, the FBI, and the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, authorities announced Sunday. He was booked for investigation of homicide in connection with the 1978 death of Marissa Harvey, 15. The San Francisco Police Department said in October 2020, they reopened the investigation and determined Personet to be a suspect using advanced investigative methods, the statement said without specifying the methods. This was from the Associated Press. Governor names CU regent to 5th District. Governor Jared Polis has appointed Republican businessman Ken Montero to serve as a new CU regent representing Colorado Springs and Southern Colorado. Montero, in 2018, ran for election for an at-large seat on the 9-member University of Colorado Board of Regents. He lost in the general election to Democrat Leslie Smith. Montero will replace Regent Chance Hill, who resigned, opening a seat for a regent residing in the 5th Congressional District, and will serve until a new regent is selected in 2022. Polis issued a statement saying he is impressed with Montero's business experience and passion for CU and making education more affordable. I'm hopeful that Ken, who has strong roots in this thriving region, is someone who will help the university achieve its full potential, Polis said. The 9 regions serve staggered 6-year terms, with one elected from each of Colorado's 7 congressional districts and 2 at-large seats. They're charged under the state constitution with supervising the university and directing expenditures. This was by Bruce Finley, the Denver Post. Aurora to pay $8,000 retention bonuses to officers using $6 million in federal funds, by Elise Schmelzer, the Denver Post. The Aurora City Council voted Monday night to spend $6 million on $8,000 retention bonuses for each of the city's police officers from the approximately $65 million the city received from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. The officers will receive $4,000 apiece in April and another $4,000 in October, in addition to the $2,000 bonus already planned for all city employees. This isn't a comprehensive strategy. This is a first step toward a comprehensive strategy, said Councilman Dustin Zvonik, who voted in support of the bonuses. The Aurora Police Department lost more than 100 officers in 2021 and more than 80 in 2020, though it has refilled many of those positions. The department on Monday had 720 officers, just 24 short of its budgeted 744 positions. Spokesman Francisco Cicedo said 31 of the 720 officers were still completing field training. The police bonuses passed with a vote of 6-4 after council members argued whether the cash payments would address the underlying conditions causing officers to leave and whether the bonuses would have any effect on the city's rising violent crime. Those in support of the bonuses said they would provide an immediate morale boost to the department, which has been thrust into the national spotlight repeatedly in the last few years due to police brutality and the 2019 death of Elijah McClain after a violent arrest. council members in support also said they hoped any increased retention would help deter crime. A lack of police presence is emboldening people to drive fast and do crimes and do stupid things, Councilman Steve Sundberg said. Several council members pointed out that there was nothing stopping officers from leaving after accepting the second payment and that there were no accountability measures tied to the money. Councilwoman Allison Coombs said the council members who supported the bonuses were using the federal money as piggy banks for their own political gains. Councilman Juan Marcano urged the city to create a strategic retention plan beyond one-time bonuses that will keep officers in the long term. He also said paying the bonuses will likely do little to prevent crime. What keeps us safe is keeping people's needs met, he said. Until we address the root causes, we're just setting money on fire. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.